The chairman of the commission, Walter Parker, was instrumental in Alaska's fight in the 1970s to enact strict tanker safety laws. And his message to Governor Cooper and House and Senate leaders was simple. Alaska needs to get back to the aggressive prevention and enforcement position it held in the early days of pipeline operation. The report calls the state of the art in oil spill technology primitive and says keeping oil out of the water in the first place is the only acceptable standard. The commission believes Alaska should go ahead and adopt stringent regulations for oil transportation without fear of being overruled by the federal government. In 1976, Alaska did adopt a tough tanker safety law, one that slapped heavy economic penalties on tanker owners that failed to invest in safer tankers. The oil industry balked at the state's aggressive stance and went to court. In 1979, the law was struck down on the grounds that the Coast Guard and Congress had preempted state authority. At that point, says Governor Steve Cooper, tough regulation of oil tankers all but disappeared.
Once the state took its eye off the ball, then the industry's standards began to erode very quickly. I think that there's a message there, and that is that states are the ones that need to go forward and protect their own coastlines.
One of the reasons that the tanker issue fell off the face of the earth for 10 years, to use Washington Senator Brock Adams' phrase, was that Alaska became too absorbed in spending the oil money to fight Congress and the Coast Guard over tanker safety. And the Coast Guard had no intention of implementing the same tough standards Alaska had used on the industry. Walt Parker reserved his harshest criticism for the Coast Guard. He acknowledged that the agency had funding problems and has been saddled with many other duties. But he said the fundamental problem is simple. When it comes to the oil industry, the Coast Guard is an extremely weak regulator.
It makes its regulations in concert with industry. The tendency is, through that process, to wind up at the lowest common denominator, regulations. The other thing in enforcement, the Coast Guard has substantially backed off on vessel inspections at every level. It really needs to take its job a great deal more seriously before we will be comfortable.
Parker added that the commission was very frustrated by the Coast Guard's attitude toward its investigation. The most hopeful sign from Washington is the new federal oil spill legislation, now awaiting conference committee action in Washington. That bill allows states to enact spill laws tougher than the federal standard. Parker sees this freedom from federal preemption as the key to a new series of strict tanker laws enacted either by Alaska alone or in concert with other coastal states. Governor Cooper supported the idea of exploring some kind of interstate compact on oil spill prevention, a coalition that could approve region-wide safety standards or pressure Congress for changes in Washington. With the oil industry still smarting from its oil tax defeat last year in Juneau, lawmakers are wondering if tough, expensive spill bills will be approved this year. For the moment, Senate President Tim Kelly says he's open to any recommendations the commission has to offer.
If we feel that it will protect the shorelines of the state of Alaska, then we're going to go ahead and enact that legislation.
House Speaker Sam Cotton says nobody wants to see the industry suffer, but he's ready for another fight if it comes down to that, and he challenges the notion that big oil will have more influence in this election year when candidates will be looking for contributions.
I don't know. It's really an interesting question. I think it's possible that they have less. Because I think one of the campaign issues this year is going to be whether or not you pursued the public interest or backed away from the powerful oil companies. And I know which side of the argument I want to be on.
House Speaker Sam Cotton. This presentation was a summary of the commission's larger 300-page report, which is expected to be finished later this month. In Juneau, I'm Peter Kenyon. Five of the six surviving former presidents who have retired from the legislature were on hand for the opening session. Brad Phillips, Jay Hammond, Chancey Croft, John Rader, and Clem Tillion were there. 79-year-old John Butrovich couldn't attend. For Rader, who was elected Senate president in 1977, the recent awakening of Mount Redoubt should serve as a warning. He called for an investigation of the Drift River facility, as well as a review of the tanker traffic and fuel storage facilities in Cook Inlet. Rader noted that the state had grown complacent before the Exxon Valdez spill and that an even larger disaster could be brewing if the volcano blows.
I don't think that we can just assume that that volcano is not going to create a problem for us.
The man who succeeded Rader in the president's chair, Clem Tillion, believes that the key is to motivate the oil industry to install the safety and cleanup measures itself by creating a strict liability system with massive penalties for every gallon of crude oil it spills.
You make a price per gallon so high that the state of Alaska shows a profit if the spill happens, and then you wait for Lloyd's of London to tell the oil companies, if you don't have a cleanup operation there standing by, this is what you're going to pay for insurance.
Former Senate President Chancey Croft, credited with sponsoring the toughest safe tanker law Alaska ever passed, holds precisely the opposite view. He says penalties after the fact are no substitute for mandated tanker safety provisions.
If you build it in to the cost of insurance, then you're going to pass on the bad practices just as well as the good practices.
Croft's tanker bill was struck down by a federal court in 1979. The State Oil Spill Commission last week urged the state to resurrect some of those provisions. The outspoken Tillian and former Governor Jay Hammond were the most quotable guests of the day. Hammond told lawmakers how Tillian used to fall asleep during meetings, and he reminded them of a few legislative principles that remain true today. First, the bills you have to watch out for are the ones that slip through with no debate, or as Hammond's first law says,
the abundance of discourse is inversely proportionate to the significance of the subject.
Hammond's second law also provides a clue as to how to recognize important issues in the Capitol.
The number of sides to a given issue is the sum of the square of the number of attorneys involved.
And Clem Tillian offered condolences to the current Senate President, Tim Kelly, who will be presiding over a Senate that to date includes two candidates for governor and at least one for lieutenant governor. Tillian advised Kelly not to worry. He said none of the grandstanding could possibly be as bad as when Mike Gravel was in the Senate and running for office. Tillian also had some thoughts on open government to share with the Senate.
I never passed up the opportunity to throw the press out. I thought that there was no substitute for the honor of the individual, and that grandstanding often cost the people more money than they could afford.
Former Senate President Clem Tillian. In Juneau, I'm Peter Kenyon.
From the ashes of the artificial government-induced economy of the early 80s, a new Alaska is rising, stronger, more diversified, more certain of our rightful place in the world. The steady improvement of the Alaskan economy since 1987 may not be as exciting as a boom, but it's a lot more solid. At the moment, some Alaskans are ambivalent about the education amendment. For those who believe that the income of the permanent fund should never be used for anything but dividends, or for those who believe that citizenship confers only rights and not obligations, I offer no rebuttal, except for the observation that those with different views should be allowed to express them at the ballot box. But I am confident that as the facts about the Education Amendment become generally known, public support for this important proposal will be reflected in passage of the amendment by the full legislature. If the requisite public support is lacking, then no doubt your actions will reflect that as well. But the Education Amendment is a rare chance to pass along the benefits of Prudhoe Bay to those who follow us.
Even though the Anchorage School District officially endorses the education endowment, dissatisfaction among school board members is growing. At a meeting Monday night, the board deadlocked on a proposal to place the education endowment on Anchorage's list of legislative priorities. Three members voted for the endowment, three against. Lacking a clear majority, the board's official position, based on a nearly unanimous vote last year, is that Anchorage favors tapping the permanent fund to pay for Alaska schools. School board president Bill Frick once counted himself among the endowment supporters, but he changed his mind after getting a dose of political reality during recent meetings with Anchorage lawmakers.
Even if it went to a vote, it wouldn't pass, and they would feel much more secure if the legislators tried to find some other way to establish the endowment fund.
Frick's not against the endowment for Alaska school systems. He just doesn't want to pay for it with the permanent fund. School board member Carol Stolpe is pleased to see Bill Frick and Daryl Jordan join her ranks. For a long time, she was the board's only opponent to the education endowment. Stolpe says waning support on the Anchorage school board won't go unnoticed.
My personal assessment is that it will have impact. We need to regularly remind ourselves that we do, in fact, have almost half the children in the state, in our school system, and that the Anchorage Board and its decisions does have substantial impact, not only with the legislature, but with other members of the education community.
But board member Betty Bruckman says the Anchorage School Board isn't sending any message at all. The official position remains that Anchorage supports the endowment. Carol Stolpe says that may not be for long. She's looking for new opportunities to bring the issue to a vote. In Anchorage, I'm Bruce Melzer.
I would say that the endowment probably does not stand a good chance of passing in the Senate, because not only does it have to get a majority, it would have to get a supermajority of 14 votes in the 20-member Senate to pass. And I think there's enough skepticism out there right now with regard to the, you know, any changes in the permanent fund, any major changes, and that sort of thing. So I suspect that the Senate would not approve it.
Three, two, one. A proposed change to the Federal Clean Air Act would require the use of oxygenated fuels in areas like Fairbanks and Anchorage, where there are carbon monoxide air quality problems. Before that happens, state officials want to make sure that the fuels will work in the long-lasting cold that makes up a Fairbanks winter. Oxygenated fuels have a higher level of oxygen in them and can help reduce vehicle emissions that pollute the air. Perhaps the best known is gasohol, an alcohol blend that's added to gasoline. Another is a gasoline additive that has become more common in the lower 48, called MTBE. It's an ether compound that has similar characteristics to ethanol, but seems to have fewer problems and is more compatible with all vehicles. The Fairbanks North Star Borough has received a $25,000 grant to check out the performance of oxygenated fuels this winter. The grant came through the Department of Environmental Conservation. DEC spokesman Ron King says oxygenated fuels have been studied in other communities, but they don't have the sustained extreme cold that Fairbanks does. King says one of the concerns about gasohol is that the alcohol blend could cause gasoline and water to separate in the fuel tank when it gets very cold. He's hoping the study here will help answer some of the DEC's questions.
We already know that an oxygenated fuel does reduce emissions. However, there are some concerns over drivability in various areas. And one of those is under cold temperature conditions in which phase separation could occur with the alcohol-based fuel here. The temperature itself is where the problem comes in with that phase separation. And we want to make sure that we are not unduly causing problems for the citizens by making a mandatory program. We may not have any choice if Congress adopts the Clean Air Act, which requires an oxygenated fuels during the CO season, which would be October 1 through March 31st. However, before we design any program around that, we want to know how it's going to perform in Alaska.
The borough's Department of Health and Safety will be conducting the study here. Kelly McMullen says the borough pursued the grant because it was concerned about a required oxygenated fuels program. Since gasohol and the MTB gasoline additive are considered the most likely candidates for a mandated program, McMullen says they, along with regular unleaded gasoline, will be used in certain borough vehicles through the end of February to see how well they perform.
We will be using 8 borough-owned vehicles with borough drivers, and having those drivers record their warm-up times and any particular problems or complaints they have about how the vehicle operates on specific fuel. They will not know which fuel they have. They will only know they have one of the 3 possible blends.
McMullen says the fuels will be used in typical vehicles that consumers would drive, sedans, pickup trucks, and vans utilized by animal control, parks and recreation maintenance staff, and the borough's medical coordinator. He wants to see how the fuels perform in the Fairbanks climate under normal operating conditions, and says the only way to know is to try them out.
It's never been tested in as cold the temperatures or as prolonged cold as we have in Fairbanks, and before you require it, we better be sure that one of these fuels is going to work without causing vehicles to stumble or stall at 40 or 50 below, as that's a public safety issue, and we want to be sure that they are compatible with our climate and our type of driving.
The testing should get underway next week and be completed by the end of February. Even though we've already had some periods of cold providing perfect testing conditions, McMullen says it's still early in January. He expects the weather will cooperate.
I think a fair assessment would be 2 or 3 days at 40 below or colder. I don't think that we need weeks at those temperatures. We would like to have a few days long enough that the vehicles go through several cold soak cycles with each type of fuel, and I don't think anyone wishes for 3 weeks of cold like last year.
And while oxygenated fuels can improve air quality by reducing carbon monoxide levels 10% to 15%, they won't have much impact on ice fog that's formed even if oxygenated fuels are burned. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton. Three, two, one. The legislation before the Assembly classifies pit bulls as dangerous dogs and would require them to either be confined or muzzled and leashed at all times. But Assembly members heard from a number of people, many of them dog owners or trainers, who felt that one breed of dog shouldn't be treated any differently than any other. They say there is a hysteria about pit bulls similar to what German Shepherds and Dobermans have been subjected to in the past. Dog trainer Jeannie Haglund says pit bulls don't even have the worst biting statistics here.
You're much more likely to be bitten by something like a sled dog and killed in Alaska than you are by a pit bull. And another thought to add to that is that the sled dogs are a multi-million dollar industry in Alaska. And I would hate to have to legislate against them because they have more bites than pit bulls.
And most of the pit bull defenders, like Karen Nelson, say it's not the dog to be worried about, but the dog owners.
People who own the dogs, 95% of the time, are using the dogs to guard their drugs. They're not really drug-related people. And these type of people could train Lassie to be a killer.
Of the more than 20 people who testified about the ordinance, only a couple had anything bad to say about pit bulls. One of them was North Pole resident Devaney Norris, whose pet duck was attacked last year by the neighbor's loose pit bull pup. But even she agreed that the owners were more to blame than the dog.
I called animal control after we managed to get the dog out of the house. All they could do is stand in my driveway and tell me they went and talked to the owners, and that the owners would keep the dog tied up, which they still don't, and that it was only a puppy. Well, this summer it's not going to be a puppy anymore, and if you think I'm going to put up with this anymore, I have news for you. I'm not. I'll take the matter into my own hands.
Also on the pit bull side was a law enforcement officer who said he has been bitten by dogs 8 times, but not one of them was a pit bull. The sponsor of the ordinance, Walt Johnson, stressed the same points to most of the pit bull supporters. The dogs were bred specifically for fighting, their attack frequency is out of proportion with their numbers, and that veterinarians support the restraints he's pushing. But those testifying came charging right back in most cases, especially Paul Gertler.
We have an extremely good ordinance that exists in this borough right now, that if the resources were supplied to those people responsible for enforcing that ordinance would work perfectly to address any problem.
So are you suggesting we wait until there's a pit bull death in Fairbanks before we do?
There's never been a pit bull death in Fairbanks.
I'm asking you. Are you suggesting we wait until there's a pit bull death in Fairbanks?
I don't think it's a matter of waiting. Do you suggest that we wait until somebody else is killed with a handgun before we put bars down the barrel of every handgun? It's such a speculative situation. What are you going to do with the sled dogs? Most of the mortalities that have occurred in this area, or bad maulings, have been related to sled dogs, yet most sled dogs are perfectly wonderful animals. I think you have to look at what you're dealing with and what the problems are and address your ordinance to a problem if there is one, not create one that doesn't exist.
Most of those testifying agree that the vicious dog ordinance on the books now is a good one, And many assembly members apparently agree, since the dangerous dog ordinance was tabled after lengthy public testimony but no assembly debate. Even though they left the dangerous dog ordinance lie, the assembly approved a change in the penalty for animal control violations. The maximum fine was lowered, while the minimum fine was increased to $50. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton.
But research cannot be done without laboratory space. While university facilities fill that need in other states, the University of Alaska's research labs are tiny and inadequate. If we don't invest in these laboratory facilities, the research will be done at the University of Washington or Oregon State or the University of Colorado or other institutions located elsewhere. I urge you to utilize a portion of the Rail Belt Energy Fund for the construction of the combined laboratory classroom buildings proposed by the University of Alaska in Anchorage and in Fairbanks. It could help us take advantage of a renewed national commitment to scientific research.
Under their definition, wetlands includes all permafrost areas in Alaska. It's been estimated that 98% of Alaska's communities are going to be affected by this policy.
In his State of the Budget speech, Cooper linked the size and shape of the capital budget to the issue of corrosion on the Trans-Alaska pipeline system.
We will report to you in detail on this matter within the next 60 days or sooner if we get the appropriate information. And as soon as the revenue implications of the pipeline repairs are a little more clear, we will introduce the capital budget.
The cost of corrosion repairs may raise the transportation fees Alaska pays for its royalty oil and also eat into tax revenues. But lawmakers interviewed Friday didn't quite see the connection between that and the capital budget. Senator Steve Frank.
I'm not sure that that makes a lot of sense, although, you know, I haven't really thought about it that much. No, that's a good question. I would assume that they are just not ready to unveil their list of priority projects.
Senator Al Adams is considering the possibility that Cooper is buying time and possibly votes as well.
It's a very good excuse, but the second thing is perhaps that when you're putting the capital budget together, you would utilize it as a tool to get people to vote for the endowment fund.
Cooper Press aide David Ramser said this week that the governor wants the Senate to put the education amendment on the November ballot, but he won't be making a lot of expensive promises to get it passed. But legislators are very interested to know what Cooper might be willing to trade for the endowment or any other of his legislative priorities. Senate President Tim Kelly also doesn't believe corrosion is the real reason for the delay in the capital budget, but he's not convinced that the budget is being simply held back to induce senators to trade their endowment votes for projects. He thinks other pots of money, like the Rail Belt Energy Fund, have more to do with the strategy. Cooper wants the fund spent on research projects like a laboratory building in Fairbanks, for instance.
Well, I think if the laboratory building for the university in Fairbanks is not funded in the Rail Belt Energy account, the governor will propose to fund that in his capital budget. And in fact, if we do fund it, and if he waits until we pass the Rail Belt Energy Fund, then he's got another $28 million to distribute in other areas of the state.
Whatever the reasons, most lawmakers are not criticizing the governor for hanging on to this one piece of the spending puzzle a little while longer. In fact, Cooper is even getting some credit for it, as evidenced by this comment from Fairbanks Representative Mark Boyer.
I mean, the longer you keep the capital budget off the table for discussion, probably the better leverage that the governor has at this particular time. And he has a number of interests. You mentioned them last night concerning the Rail Belt Energy Fund that he'd like to see on the table, too. So I think he's playing his cards right in dealing with the legislature by holding off on what will become, I think, a real feeding frenzy.
In Juneau, I'm Peter Kenyon.
I think it'll be business as usual. The only difference that I can think of is that we will have it each one of the locations staffed additionally with First National Bank people to answer questions, to try to help people in transferring accounts over to First National Bank. And we believe the sooner that's done, the easier it will be for everybody. But it'll be business as usual.
Lunch is...
3, 2, 1.
We shall obey.
The crowd that gathered in the Great Hall joined the NAACP choir in a tribute to King. A framed portrait of the slain civil rights leader will hang in the Great Hall, and it was presented for the first time on what would have been King's 61st birthday. Invited speakers talked about Dr. King's commitment to peace and freedom, and several references were made to King's dream of equality for all. But one speaker wants to see a lot more happen here to fulfill that dream. Fairbanks NAACP chapter president Vander Pearson says across the country there are still numerous violations of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, and the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission is kept busy filing court actions. Pearson says King saw affirmative action as a remedy, but in the 22 years since his death, the Fairbanks community hasn't changed enough. With Fairbanks City Mayor Jim Nordale on one side of him and UAF Chancellor Patrick O'Rourke on the other, Pearson said Fairbanks needs an affirmative action plan, and the university still has a ways to go to bring more minorities into the system.
We have to move forward in terms of hiring more black professionals on campus. I know as our faculty and staff has increased, we still haven't shown that ratio in terms of hiring more blacks campus. I think with the Board of Regents, I think it's a must. It's essential that we have black representation. I think of the history of this university, we never had a black on the Board of Regents. And there's a perception out in the black community that our state is not being fair. We're not living up to the dream of Dr. King, where all people are included.
And when Chancellor O'Rourke spoke to the group, he agreed that we have not yet achieved what King aspired to, and said individuals can take actions to help make King's dream come true. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ian Thornton.
The decision restores the power of the union that once represented community college teachers. The union was basically tossed out of the labor scene when University President Donald O'Dowd merged some 300 unionized community college teachers into a much larger non-union university. Ralph McGrath is president of the Alaska Community College Federation of Teachers. He calls the arbitrator's ruling a victory.
So it does mean that to us that we are the exclusive bargaining agent for the 300 faculty. We retain that right that when the university unilaterally extinguished that from us 30 months ago, it was a breach of contract, breach of state law, and they must bargain with us under the collective bargaining laws of the state.
Up at the administration building in Fairbanks, University of Alaska President Donald O'Dowd is not pleased by the arbitrator's ruling and says he doesn't know if the university will challenge it. Just over a quarter of the university's 900 teachers and professors are covered by the decision, and O'Dowd says it's too early to tell what changes it will bring.
That I don't know. I guess the result of it is that we would be involved in a bargaining process to arrive at an agreeable arrangement between the university and the bargaining unit.
Contract talks are now underway for 7 union members at the state's last remaining community college in Valdez. President O'Dowd says at some point those may be merged with new talks for the 250 or so instructors now represented by the revived union. The arbitrator says the union and the university must negotiate out their differences, and if the two sides fail, the arbitrator says he'll step in and make some final decisions. In Anchorage, I'm Bruce Melzer.
The law in question prohibits sex between adults and children under 18 who are entrusted to the offender's care by the authority of law. The normal legal age of consent in Alaska is 16. Carlson was charged with 2 counts of sexual abuse of a minor in the first degree for having sex with a 17-year-old female student. He admitted the relationship but argued he committed no crime, and the judge agreed. John Stone said the legislature would have named teachers in the statute if teachers were to be covered by it. John Stone said teachers are not guardians or wards as those terms are defined by legal precedent. Even if the legislature intended to include teachers, he said, the statute is unconstitutionally vague. And John Stone said the defense presented evidence the law has been applied unevenly in the past. The judge said the courts cannot allow prosecutors to define who the law applies to, no matter how distasteful the alleged conduct may appear. The state should not have the discretion, he said, to bring charges against a teacher under a law which does not clearly apply to teachers when the penalty is at least 8 years and could be as much as 30 years in prison. Johnstone also said it seems illogical that a teacher could face such penalties for having sex with a 17-year-old student when the crime of any adult having sex with a 13-year-old carries no presumptive sentence. In Anchorage, I'm Patty Harper.
3, 2, 1. For the past few months, the Borough School Board has been looking at a new policy that requires more math and science of high school kids. Even though a steady stream of teachers has come to public hearings and recommended against the changes, the board unanimously agreed last night to take the step anyway. Most of the changes will be effective for freshmen this fall. The 22-credit requirement will be put in place for the class of 1994. They'll also have to take 3 credits of science instead of 2, and the physical education requirement has been reduced by 0.5 credit, but students must take a 0.5 credit health class instead. The increased math requirements won't take effect for another year, though. Beginning in the fall of 1991, students will have to take 3 credits of math, and algebra must be one of them. The 1-year delay was deemed necessary to look at the curriculum changes the new math requirement will mean. Students will still be able to leave school in the middle of their senior year if they meet all the requirements. The board had considered changing that, but decided last night to keep the 7-semester graduation on the books. Even though the changes passed unanimously, there was some concern among board members that the new requirements might be too tough for some students, especially the necessity to take algebra. But board member Gene Redden agrees with the opinion that most of the kids can handle that class.
I think when you have higher expectations, people respond to those expectations. The concern about the math requirement, I believe most kids can do algebra. At first I thought that what we were doing was focusing on college-bound kids, but the more I looked at it and the more I was involved in the public hearings and the discussion, it became pretty obvious we're looking at skills we want all kids to have when they graduate. And I think that's all we come up with.
A few teachers raised concerns that the math requirement might discourage some students. Board President Jerry McBeth says those concerns will be taken into consideration.
Well, I think the commentary of teachers about the experience of many of our students in algebra were comments that the board took quite seriously, and that by delaying the implementation of that part of the curricular change, we'll have a chance to look carefully at the kinds of courses that are set up for students and the teaching methods we're using with them.
In addition to a change in graduation requirements, the board also was set to consider an entrance exam for incoming freshmen, but that was tabled by the board and there wasn't much interest in exploring that further. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton. 3, 2, 1. More than half of last night's session was spent dealing with an issue that's been around for more than a year and a half. Mary Susan Wilson wants to open a daycare center in a residential area, but the neighbors on York Avenue have been opposed to the business. The assembly has to approve a special permit for Wilson to open that business, and nearly 1 year ago, when the issue came up the first time, the assembly voted to deny Wilson her permit. But Wilson reapplied last July. She believes conditions that prompted denial of the permit originally have changed, and the assembly agreed this time. After going through the appeal process again, this time Wilson got the 6 assembly votes she needed to open her daycare center. That appeal process took 3.5 hours last night. After that, the assembly proceeded to rescind an action taken last week when this meeting actually began. Then there weren't enough votes to pass a fairly routine request from the mayor, her new appointments to boards and commissions. Last night, all the assembly members were there, and there were enough votes to support the mayor's appointments. The assembly also finally agreed to sell some of the borough's property through a land lottery. That is scheduled now to take place later this year with the goal of getting more borough-owned land into private ownership. Discussion on those and some other ordinances took the body right up until midnight, and there is still business to be taken care of from last week's agenda. Some of the ordinances still to be addressed are designed to broaden the assembly's powers, and one would restrict the mayor's veto powers. Those matters are now scheduled to be discussed tonight. The assembly has a regular committee meeting and will return to its unfinished agenda after that meeting is through. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton.
That the public will first approve a new income tax before they allow us to use any of the earnings of the permanent fund, because it's a fairly sophisticated idea. I mean, using...
In his first expanded public comments on the subsistence issue since the Supreme Court ruled the existing state law unconstitutional, Governor Cooper said the options right now are very limited. In his view, a state constitutional amendment is out of the question. Unwise, he called it, and probably not politically feasible. Only one subsistence bill is currently before the legislature, this proposing a hunting and fishing preference based on need. Cooper called that an insult to rural Alaskans. Subsistence, he says, cannot be equated to public welfare programs. The most likely solution, says the governor, is some kind of individual permit system under which urban and rural residents alike could qualify for subsistence permits. This approach itself, says Cooper, also has its drawbacks.
It would be cumbersome. It would be another large bureaucracy, which I don't like and which most people don't like. But after a while, you start running out of options, and that may be where we have to go. Now, it may be possible if we have a subsistence board or a subsistence commission that the only thing we need in terms of extra people would be the members of the commission itself. And they could be supported by the subsistence division over in Fish and Game.
Whether it's that approach or something else, Cooper says it'll take action by the state legislature and Congress to solve the subsistence controversy, and that, he says, will take an agreement that's backed by his administration, the legislature, the congressional delegation, and Native Alaskans.
If that group of people goes to the Congress and says, look, we got a problem here, and if you don't solve it, you're going to have to appropriate money to manage Fish and Game in Alaska. We'd always throw that little phrase in. That makes them nervous. They will change the law. They are willing to do it. And I think that those who say that it's impossible to get a fix simultaneously in the legislature and the U.S. Congress are flat wrong.
Cooper told a gathering of Juneau Democrats that he'll use his office as a focal point for drafting the proposed state legislation. And while it may take some time for the affected interest groups to react, Cooper says Alaskans have no choice but to work together.
It just comes down to a question about whether people in Alaska want to offer the federal government 67% of the land mass to manage. I think my feeling is that most people in the Native community in the end aren't going to want to do that. And if that's the case, then we've got a common goal to start with, which is to have a state statute and a federal statute that are consistent so that we can have coordinated state management on all the land in Alaska in terms of the fish and wildlife.
Governor Steve Cooper saying he'll introduce some kind of subsistence law for debate in the legislature. The governor set himself no deadline, but said he hoped to have it ready in 10 days to 2 weeks. The Supreme Court has given the state until the end of June to rework a law ruled unconstitutional just before Christmas. In Juneau, I'm John Greeley.
Arrives in Hungary on Tuesday and leaves Thursday. This is it.
I'm not doing this because I'm curious about whether I'm right or wrong. I think it's essential to the operation of the borough that we not be taken over by a committee and have the day-to-day operations stopped until every 2 weeks the assembly meets. The fact is the assembly is a volunteer body. They don't work.
Well, if the mayor is filing a lawsuit to get some guidance from the court, I think that's quite appropriate. The mayor's needed some guidance for quite some time. We've tried to give it to her, but she's been a little remiss in her willingness to accept it. She is squirming around in, you know, last-ditch effort sort of thing. I really see no conflict. Title 29 is quite clear, and it's stating what the assembly's authority is. We can decide how a budget is prepared and submitted. It says right there in black and white.
And in the past, the mayor
of the borough has been able to use the veto power to increase appropriations that the borough assembly has made. And that's the point that the assembly was most concerned with, using veto powers to actually raise appropriations rather than to just strike them or reduce them. The way the assembly acted is completely out of hand because, at the last work session, we had 53 budget transfers before us. A lot of that's categorical, just taking it out of block grant money and et cetera, and the assembly stated it wasn't their intention to handle things that way.
And so all the assembly is saying is we want to approve this. It isn't slowing government down. It isn't slowing it down in the least. So I would totally disagree with her, and I would say that the powers have all become one-sided, and that is why there are 11 people elected to set policy in this community so that they can look at what's being done and a balance stays there. As it is right now, the administration has full power to do whatever they want with the money.
Well, if the mayor is filing a lawsuit to get some guidance from the court, I think that's quite appropriate. The mayor's needed some guidance for quite some time. No, I think really that the mayor's hanging on by her fingernails. She is squirming around in last-ditch effort sort of thing. I really see no conflict. Title 29 is quite clear, and it's stating what the assembly's authority is. We can decide how a budget is prepared and submitted. It says right there in black and white.
The assembly has had and continues to have a propensity to try to run the day-to-day affairs of the borough, and by these actions, the ordinances themselves that the assembly has tried to usurp her authority, and since they've overridden her veto, this is the only recourse that she had to take, and I commend her for it. And this is one of the problems that the assembly now has created, that they're creating lawsuits and costs to the citizens that could have been avoided if they hadn't tried to usurp her authority. Some members of the assembly have acted irresponsibly, and so now we're going to have to go to court and get this issue resolved, and hopefully they'll straighten up from there on.
They don't work here every day. To have them responsible for the day-to-day operations of the borough would just bring us to a screeching halt. We would not be serving the public, and it's happening now in the borough. And I think it's important that this question be settled. And I'm only hoping that this will settle it. Politically, I don't know whether it's a good move or not. I think as I have a responsibility, I took an oath that I was going to comply with the Constitution and the laws of the state of Alaska, and those laws are being violated. And I think it's my responsibility to make sure that it doesn't happen. Talking about...
For your side.
Right. But I think you have to remember that we're talking about a choice between permitting the assembly, the legislative body, to become the administrators of the borough, which then slows down anything that the borough does and increases the cost of doing business. So I think that the cost of the lawsuit is going to be quite a bit lower than not instituting a lawsuit.
Dividend eligibility requirements apparently contribute.
William Dorsey of Portland, Oregon was called in to pick the last best offer. The union asking for a raise to cover inflation. The Cooper administration saying no raise was warranted because they're paid enough already. Dorsey sided with the union, saying basic fairness was at stake. He granted a one-time retroactive payment of $675 to 400 members of the union, and then for this calendar year said a 4.6% raise was in order. Local 71 business manager Don Valesco says he hopes the arbitrator's award for 25% of his membership can be extended to the other 1,200 people he represents.
Well, that's the work that I'm trying to work on now. I'm going to be trying to put together a package and make a proposal to the state to apply that to our whole unit and see how it's received.
Governor Steve Cooper said last week he would support funding of any arbitrator's award. State Labor Relations Chief Bruce Cummings estimates that if the pay raise and one-time retroactive payment is extended throughout the Local 71 membership, it would cost the state treasury about $5 million. Dorsey said he took into account the fact that these state workers had not had a pay raise since 1985, and he said with oil prices up, the state can't afford to pay Local 71 members more to make up for the 5% cost of living rise in the years between those raises. These workers hold down blue and gray-collar jobs at the state jails, hospitals, and pioneer homes. Reacting to the arbitrator's award, other union leaders that have been fighting the Cooper administration for new contracts said they hoped this labor victory would lay the ground for others. Two other major state unions are also seeking pay raises in the neighborhood of 4%. Arbitration is underway or will be soon for those unions as well. In Juneau, I'm John Greeley.
One key factor is a major fire, the biggest one in 10 years. The number of people we have, we can't control that, and that's basically the Frontier Lodge fire. A very significant fire, and if we get others of that magnitude with the amount of people, you may very well see similar results.
We'll be soon for those unions as well. In Juneau, I'm John Greeley.
Although I know the governor is very interested in it, and he will has made it a priority and will.
3-2-1. Over the past few weeks, the verbal battles between the mayor and the assembly have been heating up. Mayor Helm says she thinks everyone will be relieved that the conflict will be resolved in the courts. She acknowledges that she's not sure if a lawsuit is a good move politically, but sees it as a matter of keeping the administrative functions out of assembly members' hands.
They don't work here every day. To have them responsible for the day-to-day operations of the borough would just bring us to a screeching halt. We would not be serving the public, and it's happening now in the borough. And I think it's important that this question be settled. And I'm only hoping that this will settle it.
The separation of powers issue is a battle for control of the borough's budget. The assembly has passed two ordinances that the mayor doesn't agree with. One gives the assembly the power to approve budget transfers. The other gives the assembly the power to propose the borough's budget instead of the mayor. The mayor says state statute gives her that job. The assembly says state statute allows it to make the rules. The mayor vetoed both the ordinances she believes are illegal. The assembly overrode those vetoes. There are three members of the borough assembly who are on the mayor's side. One of the most outspoken has been Don Lowell, who commends the mayor's action, saying she had no recourse. The eight assembly members who backed these ordinances also have the power to override any future vetoes of ordinances that the mayor may think chip away at her authority. Lowell has said repeatedly that the assembly was going too far and now must pay the price.
Some members of the assembly have acted irresponsibly, and so now we're going to have to go to court and get this issue resolved, and hopefully they'll straighten up from there on.
Other assembly members don't see it that way. Donna Gilbert says it's ridiculous for the mayor to sue the assembly over a petty fight. Gilbert maintains that the assembly is only taking back powers that rightfully belong to the legislative branch. She says things like having the Assembly approve budget transfers is simply shifting back to more of a balance because the administration has too much control now.
So all the Assembly is saying is we want to approve this. It isn't slowing government down. It isn't slowing it down in the least. So I would totally disagree with her, and I would say that the powers have all become one-sided, and that is why there are 11 people elected to set policy in this community so that they can look at what's being done and a balance stays there. As it is right now, the administration has full power to do whatever they want with the money.
And Joe Ryan, who sponsored the budget management ordinance that the mayor doesn't like, says what the Assembly is doing is perfectly legal.
I think really that the mayor's hanging on by her fingernails. She is squirming around in, you know, last-ditch effort sort of thing. I really see no conflict. Title 29 is quite clear. And it's stating what the Assembly's authority is. We can decide how a budget is prepared and submitted. It says right there in black and white.
One of the points that the mayor did not mention as part of the lawsuit is one that the Assembly would like to see resolved. That's the mayor's veto power. Assembly members believe the mayor has used vetoes in such a way as to effectively do their job on some appropriations. Presiding Officer Paul Chismar, who has sided with the mayor on the ordinances she says are illegal, believes that the issue of vetoes is really the most important one to be resolved.
The mayor of the borough has been able to use the veto power to increase appropriations that the borough assembly has made. And that's the point that the assembly was most concerned with, using veto powers to actually raise appropriations rather than to just strike them or reduce them.
Chismar says he hopes that question can be resolved in the course of this lawsuit. Both the mayor and the assembly have to hire outside counsel to argue their sides, which will add to the expense of the legal action. And borough taxpayers are picking up the tab. But Mayor Helms believes this action may actually be cost-effective.
But I think you have to remember that we're talking about a choice between permitting the assembly, the legislative body, to become the administrators of the borough, which then slows down anything that the borough does and increases the cost of doing business. So I think that the cost of the lawsuit is going to be quite a bit lower than not instituting a lawsuit.
Helm says she hopes the matter can be resolved quickly since it affects the whole budget process. She says there are questions that need to be answered prior to budget preparation so they'll know how to handle it. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornson. For the past few months, the mayor of the Fairbanks North Star Borough has been telling the borough assembly that some of the ordinance they're passing. For the past few months, the mayor of the Fairbanks North Star Borough has been telling the borough assembly that she thinks some ordinances they've been passing are illegal. Today, the mayor announced she's filing suit against the assembly members. Hear the details on KUAC Local News tomorrow morning at 6:30 and 11:55 on KUAC FM. Over the last few months, the mayor of the Fairbanks North Star Borough says the borough assembly has been slowly chipping away at her authority by passing ordinances giving them control over the administrative portion of the government.
Visitors Bureau Board Chairperson Marcia Snyder says she's pleased an illegal initiative did not go through. Snyder says she hasn't seen the new petition the ITA is circulating, but she suspects it won't have the same problems.
Himself up inside, the pilot reached over and closed and locked the door. Martineau coughed.
Doris Giusti runs the state job service office.
This is the most snow I've ever seen in my life. I've been here in Valdez for my third winter. And I thought the snow was bad last year. This year is just, it's unbelievable. I've never seen anything like it. You know, the snow on our roof's been shoveled off a lot of times, and the snow then is piling up around the house, so it's almost entirely covered. And the other night I was listening, it was about midnight, I was laying in bed, and I could hear a cat meowing on the top of my roof. And It meowed for probably 30 minutes, and pretty soon I heard a dog on our roof. And the dog and the cat got in a fight on our roof, and the dog ended up falling off on one side. That's how deep the snow is.
By the way, Doris says the job service is not looking for snow shoveling fortune hunters. The local labor force is just barely keeping up. Tom Gilson was born and raised in Valdez. He says he never saw quite this sort of winter in the old days.
No, it is a lot of snow. I haven't seen anything like this ever since I can remember. Being born here in 1950, I haven't seen anything like it. We had something like 47.5 inches in one 24-hour period. That's snow.
Now, the city has had more snow fall in a winter than has fallen so far, but I take it it's just this incredible rate. You mentioned the 47 inches in 24 hours. Is the city keeping up? Are the roads open?
Yes, the roads are open, Dave, but things, I think there was, people lost their tempers a bit for a while there when the city crews couldn't keep up with the demand, and apparently they had one weather report that wasn't entirely accurate, and turns out they got about 40 more inches of snow than they thought, and they didn't get their crews out there right away, and I think the people getting ready to go to work when they tried to get out of their driveways and onto the street, thinking that it normally was plowed and it wasn't, got stuck, and things just went downhill from there. We've never had so many phone calls here at the city offices over any kind of a snowfall that I can remember.
One of the things I think is remarkable and that most people don't realize is that the kind of snowfall you're getting in Valdez would shut down any other place, I think, in the state. But your life goes on. Are schools open despite the snowfall?
Yeah, in fact, as I heard that the superintendent of schools, they were talking about closing the schools for the first time in recent memory. Fact is, I don't think they've ever had to close the schools down. They were talking about it because of the snow loads on the roofs, and they were putting out an appeal for like 30 snow shovelers over the weekend. If they didn't get them, then they would have to close the schools. But I think they got them, and they got the snow off the roofs, and school was open, so I guess we didn't have to close our schools after all.
Well, Tom, if you remember anything like this at all back from the old town days where the snow was stacked up like this and people were tunneling out of their houses?
Well, in the old days, that we didn't have the street cleaning equipment that we have nowadays, and generally there would be a lot of snow out in the streets, much more than you would, you might see 4 or 5 feet of snow. It's because earlier they didn't have those. They run a bulldozer down the street. That's how they'd have to clear the streets. But generally, nowadays, they keep up with it because they have bigger and better pieces of equipment that can move snow much easier than they have the wide buckets and all of that. Back in those days, I don't believe they even had front-end loaders. So, and then, of course, the city wasn't very... didn't have the budgets that it has to work with nowadays, and they used to get Army surplus type equipment, and that wasn't always so reliable.
Tom Gilson, a hometown boy, reflecting on the industrial strength art of snow removal in Valdez.
3-2-1. Assembly members were nearly 2 hours into the meeting before discussion of the lawsuit came up. And that started with a move to hold a closed-door session to decide on legal counsel. But before that happened, Assemblymember Chris Birch read a letter to the mayor that he and 8 other members had signed. In it, Birch complained about finding out about the suit through the media and called litigation an inappropriate first step toward resolving the problem. Then he extended an olive branch to the mayor.
May we schedule a work session without outside counsel to resolve the legitimate issues of assembly concern regarding veto authority, budget transfers, and related items without wasting public funds on litigation. Yours for good government, and 9 assembly members signed.
Mayor Juanita Helm says she was disappointed that the letter came after she filed suit, but doesn't see the issue as one which can be negotiated. Helm says it shouldn't have come as a surprise that she didn't like the ordinances, since she objected to them before they were passed and vetoed them later. She says both sides believe very strongly that they're right, and the only way to resolve that is to take it to a knowledgeable third party, like a judge, to decide.
And that, to me, will resolve some of the conflicts, a lot of the conflicts, I think, that are going on between the Assembly and me, because we disagree about where our authorities begin and end. And this lawsuit answers that question. And to me, it isn't the kind of thing you can negotiate away. It's a responsibility that's given by state statute to each of us. It doesn't give us the right to yield to the other to take over our responsibility.
Assembly members say they'd still like to pursue the letter, but agreed to hire an attorney on their behalf as a matter of self-defense. And awaiting Assembly action next month is an ordinance to give an additional $80,000 to the borough's legal department budget. Part of that money is needed to cover the legal fees for the new lawsuit. A couple more ordinances that the mayor doesn't like came up for a final vote last night, but neither was approved. One of them was over who has authority to hire and fire the borough attorney. That one was only postponed for 2 weeks. But the other was one the mayor mentioned in her lawsuit as an effort by the Assembly to control borough personnel figures. That ordinance didn't get enough votes to pass, so two more bones of contention were held off. But Mayor Helms doesn't necessarily see that as encouraging news.
Well, I've found over the last 3 or 4 months that just because something gets postponed or defeated does not mean that it's not going to come back to haunt us. There are some of these ordinances that are before us now for maybe the fourth try because some Assembly people don't give up. Until there's some consistent actions over a sustained period of time, I'm not going to be real optimistic.
And the differences between the two branches of government will likely resurface again next week. The mayor has vetoed 3 more ordinances that the Assembly passed last week. One of those ordinances dealt with the mayor's veto authority. The mayor says the ordinance is illegal because the Assembly cannot alter state statutes. Attempts to override those vetoes could be made next week when the Assembly reconvenes again on Tuesday evening. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ian Thornson. 3, 2, 1. Last year, the Salvation Army provided shelter for nearly 500 people locally. Some 30 hot meals a day are served at the shelter. But the emergency shelter has been operating in the red, and now the old debts have caught up with the Corps. Commanding Officer Charles Gillies.
The Salvation Army is faced with a tough dollars decision, and that's what it is. It's dollars decision. And that is, can we keep our emergency shelter program, which involves the 16 beds, 12 for men and 4 for women, and the breakfast and dinner feeding program open? With our current financial situation, the answer is, as of February 26th, no.
Gilly says actually it's something that should have been done 3 months ago, given the Salvation Army's financial situation. He says $70,000 is needed to fully fund the emergency shelter operation through June, the end of the fiscal year. But he's not that optimistic. Instead, he's hoping to make it a 2-week-at-a-time proposition. For every $7,500 contributed, the shelter will stay open 2 more weeks. More than $22,000 is needed to stay open until Easter.
I'm not comfortable with closing in the middle of the cold weather. Bottom line is, I don't want to be pessimistic, but another Christmas effort is what, you know, the month of December when the Salvation Army is out is probably not realistic. But if we can raise a portion, $7,500 of that in 2 weeks period of time, and just keep extending for a period of time until at least the cold weather is over, that's my goal, my hope.
Gilly says the financial problems cannot be pinned on any one thing, but a variety of things. The Army has provided shelter since 1951 when it first started here. Recently, it's expanded its services, going into drug abuse treatment and AIDS counseling, nutrition education, and after-school daycare, medical, and dental care. Gilly says those things have helped spread out costs rather than been a drain on finances. It's other things, like having to pay staff instead of being able to rely on volunteers due to federal laws, professional staff needed for treatment programs, and an increasing number of clients in programs like drug treatment, but not a corresponding increase in money for the program. So they've had to do more with less. Even though the Salvation Army gets money from the city and the United Way, it still needs more than $100,000 to keep programs going at current levels. With less than a month to raise the necessary money, Gillies has already checked into alternative housing for the homeless. He says some groups, like homeless families, runaway teenagers, and single men with children, have few places to turn. Women in Crisis and Counseling Assistance helps with housing for single women with children, but the Rescue Mission and the Salvation Army are where the single men and women in town must go. Bill Parham runs the Rescue Mission. He says it has housed as many as 50 men and a couple dozen women and is ready for any more that the Salvation Army may send over.
No problem. We're sitting here ready to go. We've had a lot of comments, people that have confused the two or think we're part of the same or whatever, and that's not the case. But we're sitting here ready, willing, and able. Facilities are here. The people are here. We're ready to go.
If the Salvation Army shelter does shut down, contingency plans include referring people to the remaining shelters in town and also working on finding lodging for groups that need more help. The Army may look to local hotels to help find lodging for families with children who are homeless or single men with children. And if the shelter would reopen later, the population it would serve might change. Gilly says the focus will be on which part of the homeless population will be served best and what's the best way to do that with available dollars. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornson.
State Parks Division has been given the okay to look for a developer for a new resort in Denali State Park on the south side of the Alaska Range. The controversial project has been on and off the drawing boards for years. The National Park Service is likely to chip in for the South Denali Resort in hopes that it will take pressure off Denali National Park, where traffic on the park's one road is scaring wildlife away. The resort plan, approved by Natural Resources Commissioner Lenny Gorsuch, has been considerably scaled back from the Teflon-domed city once proposed for the area by former Senator Mike Gravel, but would still involve the expenditure of a substantial number of state dollars. Bruce Melzer reports.
The Department of Natural Resources wants to entice developers by using $14.5 million in state money to put in roads, sewers, electric service, and $5.5 million for a visitor center. Gorsuch says they haven't made the funding request official.
We have not made a request. We certainly have provided information to both legislators and the Cooper administration as to what we think the cost of those facilities would be.
While Gorsuch doesn't make any predictions whether the legislature will come up with the money, this project arrives during an election year when lawmakers are eager to show they're doing something for the economy. And the governor says there's enough money to fund an increase in state government. And what's more, the state says it's going to get out and sell this project to potential developers. Gorsuch envisioned state officials traveling around talking to major domestic and foreign companies about the opportunity in Alaska. But Cliff Ames from the Alaska Center for the Environment sees an opportunity of a different sort.
And I think that it is probably fair to say that a great many managers of parks in the lower 48 wish that they could have now the opportunity that we have now, which is to protect those natural values inside the park boundaries and site commercial facilities just outside of the boundaries.
Ames opposes the South Denali project because it chips away at the wilderness parks are supposed to protect. What makes this project an even bigger disappointment, says Ames, is that there's a suitable site right outside the park boundary on Alaska Railroad land. State officials say the alder-covered lowlands simply don't have the views of Mount McKinley the tourists will come see. That may not stop the railroad from developing the site anyway. Marvin Yetter, who heads up the railroad's real estate section, says if the state project is a go, the railroad may consider some tourist-oriented development of its own. Proposals for developing state land on the south side of Mount McKinley have been floating around since the early 70s, when Mike Gravel championed a Teflon-domed recreation city. State officials figure this time they have a project for South Denali that will actually get built. The project could raise the state $300,000 a year in fees from concessionaires. They hope to have the bid documents out to developers by March. Companies will have 5 months to respond. I'm Bruce Melzer.
3, 2, 1. One of the reasons why the state legislature rejected the annexation plan last year was because no one lived there. The borough could expect its tax base to expand by $1.7 million a year, but would have had to do very little in return. Now, a new proposal has been recommended. It expands the area to be annexed from some 200 square miles proposed by the borough to more than 4,000 square miles, and it includes the communities of Livengood, Central, and Circle Hot Springs. The recommendation is contingent upon agreement by the Fairbanks North Star Borough, but Borough Mayor Juanita Helms isn't sure the new proposal is worth pursuing.
During the last...
3, 2, 1. One of the reasons why the state legislature rejected the annexation plan last year was because no one lived there. The borough could have expected its tax base to expand by $1.7 million a year, but very little would have had to be done in return. Now, a new proposal has been recommended. It would expand the area to be annexed from some 200 square miles proposed by the borough to more than 4,000 square miles. It would also include about 77 new residents and the communities of Livengood, Central, and Circle Hot Springs. The recommendation is contingent upon agreement by the Fairbanks North Star Borough, but Borough Mayor Juanita Helms says the changes may not be popular with some of the area residents.
During the last public hearing that we had on our annexation, which was a very small annexation, we got testimony that made it very clear that there are people in those areas that don't want to have anything to do with us. I don't think it's worth the negative feelings that I think it would cause to pursue it.
But the mayor says the decision would be up to the borough assembly. It must approve a resolution going along with the new annexation plan. The plan is up for public review through March the 12th. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornson.
Well, I started out this morning in Valdez, and I think that one of the old adages of politics is you dance with the people that brought you to the dance, and I've always enjoyed very strong and widespread support here in the Fairbanks area, and certainly I would be remiss if I didn't come here and indicate to the people here on the first day that I intend to be a candidate for governor.
3, 2, 1. Just last week, Golf Association members asked the Assembly to set aside 140 acres for the golf course. The undeveloped borough land they want is near the Hesray Softball Complex, south of Davis Road between Lathrop Street and Pegger Road. Part of the property is owned by the state, but Golf Association members think they can acquire it if the borough commits the larger parcel of land to the golf course. The property would be a cross-country ski area in the winter. One thing almost everyone agrees on is that an 18-hole golf course is needed. Only the 9-hole course at the Fairbanks Golf and Country Club is available to the public now. The other course in town at Fort Wainwright is getting a lot of civilian use. Golf Association members say it's reaching the point of too much use. The argument that it will increase tourism here scored the most points with the borough assembly. Bonnie Williams says after hearing from the Golf Association, she went out and bought some golf magazines and found one that included a golf travel guide with locations of golf courses all over the country.
Yes, the state of Alaska was listed. The city of Anchorage, 4 public golf courses. No other cities exist in the state of Alaska as far as the golf traveling public is concerned. So if you were considering maybe going and visiting Alaska and you love to play golf, you would put Anchorage on your list, but you would not put Fairbanks on your list.
William says the borough wouldn't lose money on the venture because of the increased tourism, and John Davies says not only would it draw tourists, but conventions as well.
I get almost once a week some mail that promotes tourism issues, and one of the prime attributes of any convention destination city is that there's golf available. And to argue that this won't benefit tourism in this town is to have your head in the sand.
The only assembly members opposed to the plan were concerned about private business. Harold Gillum says the Golf Association was already pursuing the plan without tax support, so the borough didn't need to get involved. And Donna Gilbert maintains it's not something the borough needs to undertake.
I don't think the borough has any business running a golf course.
And I think before we get to this stage that we owe it to ourselves and the people of this community, and particularly the private sector people, to sit down and get some more information and some answers and see if we can bring the country club together with this group and maybe find a general direction and maybe work something out. But just to go ahead and promise this land, I think it's criminal. I don't think it should be done.
But Bonnie Williams says it's not something the private sector can do easily because of the amount of land that's involved. And Williams pointed out that the borough has put in other public facilities without waiting for the private sector to address the need.
It is not at all unusual for a municipal government or a state government to supply large-scale recreational facilities. 18-hole golf courses, with the amount of land acreage that they require, falls into that category. Exactly that kind of a category. And I suggest that the only way this community will ever get one is through some public agency. We will never receive one through private enterprise. It does not pay.
The only other real objection to supporting the land commitment was the signal it might send to the legislature. Assemblymember Chris Birch says if the assembly goes on the record as supporting the golf course, it may also be a show of support to get $5 million from the state to develop it. And Birch was concerned that there may be more important things the borough needs to ask the state for.
We are going to get into the box of doing is sending a mixed set of signals to our interior delegation that's down there so capably representing us in Juneau as to just what our priorities are here. We've talked about a $23 million landfill and a variety of other life safety needs that we have. And then comes along as I recall, it was around a $5 million amount that we are going to pursue the legislature for.
With that concern in mind, the Assembly did change the resolution so that it supports the land set aside. But any reference towards supporting the funding request in order to develop that land was removed. The Golf Association now must work on that aspect of the proposal through the state legislature. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton.